Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten. And on this week's episodes, we're talking about players who should move this window, including Marcus Rashford. Then we open up the burn book. While over on the subscription side, we're taking a look at Arsenal's attack. How can the Gunners bolster it in the absence of Bukayo Saka? Before we give you our health and well-being tips for 2025. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So Pete Dorman, that is. We're back for our first episodes of 2025. How you doing?
I'm good. Happy to be back. New year, third calendar year of the podcast, I think. 2022.
No, we started 21.
Did we start in 21? Fourth calendar year.
No, sure, maybe we did start in 22. Yeah, 22, all, 23, 24, 25.
Fourth calendar year.
Fourth calendar year.
Maths and memory are taking a real hit in the first few minutes of this podcast. But I'm very well. How are you, Patrick? How was your festive period?
I'm good, man. It was good. I'm tired. I saw my parents. I saw my wife's parents. That's a lot of parents. But it's nice. It was actually really nice to see my parents because my dad retired last year, but previous to that had been a vicar for like 30 years.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. Christmas, very busy time. Yeah.
Yeah, he's like working every Christmas. So my parents came to us and my dad was like, this is our first Christmas away from home in 30 years. Like,
well, he's not in the manger with baby Jesus.
Exactly. Well, he's in there, you know, like telling Mary to bear down and push, all that shit.
Be a trad wife.
You obviously know all about this, though, having taken your own trad wife to an antenatal class this week.
Yeah, that was interesting. So that was yesterday evening, our inaugural antenatal class, two months out or so from the baby's due date. And it was interesting.
Did anyone approach you about the podcast?
No, absolutely not. But I'm assuming they're saving. So I think in week three or week four, the instructors have arranged just a pub day where they don't attend, but just the expectant parents attend. So, you know, where we can really get to know each other and and get into the nitty gritty stuff. I'm assuming that's when that will be tabled and we'll do maybe like a live listening to whatever episode is out that week. But
we'll make it a drop that week.
Yeah, yeah. The experience itself was interesting. It was quite an eclectic mix of people. It was a really strange blend of backgrounds, ages, general like vibe. You know, where you can tell a vibe of a person being like, I think I can get on with you without much difficulty versus
of course,
I think you might be a freak. But obviously you don't want to say that. And then also the added pressure. This is before you even like get to the extensive information about birth and all of that. The expectations seem to be that large portions of this class will be in our lives for decades to come. The both instructors say that they are still very close friends with people they met in their antenatal class, etc. And I was looking about being like, with some of you, I can see that's fine. With others, I'm hoping I can dodge that bullet. That's just off vibes alone.
The bullet can be dodged. You know, but like,
yeah,
the thing is, like, there's the desperation factor, which is 6 months in, like, your partner's on mat leave.
Yeah.
And she's just like, we fucking need to go and see some other people with a child. Like, we need to make this happen. And in those moments, you know, like, you go around somebody's house and they hand you a drink wordlessly, like, the second you walk in the door. And you're like, you were there when I needed a neighbour. Like, you were there.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we're in a somewhat fortunate scenario in that Jess's best friend is also just happens to be pregnant with her second child due within, I can't remember if she's 2 weeks ahead or 2 weeks behind Jess, but she lives in the area that we're going to the antenatal classes. So Jess will have, they'll be on mat leave together. So they'll have a great time. So I suppose that alleviates a lot of the pressure of having to find a local or local friends.
Yeah, yeah.
With, you know, babies around the same age, because just so happens Jess's best friend's second child will be the exact same age as our child, which is really nice for the future. And also, because they did antenatal classes the first time, you're not going to go back for your second baby. She's not going to gain new friends, new mum friends, whereas Jess will have her.
Yeah, it's like having to reset an exam. if you have to go back.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
It's like, it's embarrassing.
So, yeah. So this week, well, the first hour, I was like, this is a waste of fucking money because it's all common sense. It was basically like, what can you do to put yourself and your partner in a good mindset when you start labor? And it was all like, breathe, have snacks, watch TV. Don't think it was all just like not. I was like, have we paid however much? I mean, obviously Jess arranged it. I have no idea how much to pay. Sure. Have we paid? And then the second half was actually much more informative. It was actually about like the birth process and what's going to happen. And apparently next week is very, very heavy. It's about the pain relief and complications. So I mean, all the shit that can go wrong.
Sure. But like, as in, you know, you have a basic idea of the shit that can go wrong.
Yeah. I mean,
It's quite unusual to go in as well, and they'll be like, everything seemed fine, but now loads of shit is going wrong. Like, that's unusual.
Like, most of it is absolute common sense, and most of the other stuff is, like, just slightly greater detail of things you probably already roughly knew. Things like being, like, when would we, like, roughly go home after the birth? Shit like that. And they're like, they'll give you a general answer being, like, could be, you know, most first-time mums stay overnight. It kind of depends on when the baby's born, also depends on how easy the labor is, etc. And I was like, I kind of assumed that anyway. Thanks for the confirmation. It was a lot of that.
I've got to say, my tips.
Okay. Oh, yeah, this is good.
Okay. So, tip number one is obviously just like, you know, you have the birth plan in mind and like you're in there, like ready to go with it. Because chances are she will not be in like a reasonable state of mind. So, you're like,
just
obviously, the
put it on like a sandwich board.
That gets fucking you kind of need that, like hanging around her neck, because honestly it gets fucking difficult when like there are moments where there are sometimes difficult moments like that. So like they were coming and asking Emma questions the first time round, and I was like, Emma, I can't decide for you whether you're gonna get like an epidural.
Sure.
But you are going insane because of like because of the pain you're in, because her back was really bad. So, like, please just fucking have an epidural. But anyway, like, my actual tips are, if they can stay in the hospital the first night, make that happen. And then you go home, get a good rest, and then you're in, like, the best possible position the next day. That's my main tip.
I think it'll be fine. Sure. We'll give it a good crack and see what happens.
Mate, honestly, like, when you think about it, you're like, the thickest people in the world are able to do this.
That's literally...
They don't do a good job, but they get it done.
I said that so many times to Jess. I was like, we're married. Like, it seems so daunting. And I've been like lying in bed thinking like, fuck, this is happening. I have no idea what's going to happen. But then I think, you know, we're in our 30s. We're married. We have a house. We have good jobs that are stable jobs with good income. Like, we could not be in a better position. We've planned the pregnancy as well. Like, we've got intentionally pregnant. We could not be in a better position. And there's so many people I know, or like have people who I knew from school, whatever, not necessarily friends, just like random people that have been in and out of my life at whatever point. I've seen them have kids and I've been like, either one, you're an idiot, or two, this scenario is fucked here, or both. And they've been fine.
Yeah. It's honestly like, it's one of those things, isn't it? Where like, kind of like doing a degree, you're like, you can do it to a better or worse standard, but you have to honestly be really, really, really fucking stupid to not get it done at all. Like, that's just how it is.
Well, like, or, if you're not leaving with at least a third, there's something really fucked up. You should never come in the first place.
Yeah. Unless something else...
Bad choice of words. Or maybe a good choice of words.
Yeah, okay. Like, obviously, you know, look, serious things can happen to people while doing degrees and while having children that can make it harder. But if you're just doing it, you know, like... If it's just a normal speed run and you're just like, you know, kind of flunking it,
yeah,
you might want to look in the mirror. That's a skill issue. Okay. All right, that's enough of that. Honestly, though, I said to Emma, I was like, I'm really excited for Pete and Jess.
Yeah.
I'm so fucking glad it isn't me. I was like, I've really enjoyed it, but like having done it twice, I was like, I'm so done with it. Like, I like the stage you're at now. But boy. It's fun. Ish. If you
oh, fucking hell.
We're going to have to get like a tiny mean boys / mean girls hat made for whatever you end up having.
Yeah.
Having. Or obviously a third gender as well.
Yeah. And there were.
Mean. They, them.
Me. Yeah. And the some form of microplastics for the collective. Microplastics branded apparel.
I think that they'll already be carrying that, right? Inside their body.
What? sure.
I think they absorb microplastics through the umbilical cord. I think that's how that happens.
I would like some branding, though, just so people know.
Like an actual brand.
Yeah.
Go, like, this is mine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do sometimes think that about, like, in the hospital, because I look around at other people's kids and I'm like, woof, God. Like, at least I know my kids are mine because they fucking look exactly like me.
Yeah.
But imagine if our kid had got switched for that one. That would have been bad.
But also, like, they all look like potatoes for the first, like, 2 weeks anyway.
Yeah, but there are nice potatoes, and then there are, like, those weird, knobbly, fucked up ones that you wouldn't...
Yeah, that have been left in the back of the cupboard for, like, 4 months.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I do feel like, you know, you like a child based on how kind of cool the child is and how much you like their parents, I guess, you know. I always like the kids that I like the most are not the cutest kids. They're the kids who are just, like, not dickheads.
Fair enough.
That's probably enough of that. All right. It's January. Transfer window's open. Not much happening so far, but we thought we'd talk about some players who should maybe move clubs, some more realistic, some less. And the reason this topic suggested itself was because of all the talk around Marcus Rashford. Like, Marcus Rashford seems to be happy to leave Man United. And as it turns out, Man United are very clearly facing an economic reality that they never really expected to come face to face with, right? Like, rumours now that they are willing to listen to offers for anyone in the squad, including Garnacho and Mainoo. Now, obviously, I think they're going to charge insane money for them, and I can't imagine they end up selling them. But it basically sounds like United are kind of thinking, we have to rebuild the squad and we have no money and nobody wants to buy our shit, so we're going to have to sell some good guys. Rashford is a difficult one because Rashford is not shit, but he's also not very valuable to United right now. Like, right? He's not played that much. It sounds like Amorim certainly seems to have just, like, had enough instantly of him, which is kind of shocking. So do you want to give, like, some kind of background to the situation? Then we can talk a bit about what Rashford is and isn't at this stage of his career.
Yeah, so with Rashford, it's, you know, when we did the Ten Hag Amorim episode of Ten Hag gets sacked, Amorim's probably coming in, I did voice a lot of reservations with numbers of player in the squad, including Rashford, about how he would struggle, or I believed he would struggle to fit into Amorim's system because he doesn't want to play as a nine and he's not a natural fit in those, a block of attacking two midfielders that Amorim plays with. Yeah. And I struggled to see how he would fit in Amorim's system, and he doesn't want to be a nine. We don't need him to be a nine. We've signed Højlund. There's Xerxes there as well. We're linked with Randall Colomurani already this window. We're constantly linked with Gyökeres at Sporting. Like, there are a huge amount of people ahead of him vying for that nine role that Rashford doesn't even want. So any way I looked at Rashford under Amorim, it was like just a square peg in a round hole. Load of round holes, and he was just a square peg. And it has kind of come to light, because if you look at him across the season, he's got about, I think he's got over 1,000 minutes a season. But he started 12 of the first 13 games this season, but only two of those have come since Amorim has taken the reins. He started Amorim's first game at number nine, and then since then he's only featured in the block of two attacking midfielders when he has featured, and that has been sparingly. So it's clear to see that Amorim isn't really considering him as a role for that nine. Like, that was the first game he used him, and since then hasn't been in that position. So he basically, if he's going to make it work at United under Amorim, he needs to be one of those two attacking midfielders. One of them will, the other one will be likely Bruno Fernandes whenever he's not suspended. Yeah. And it's just not a natural fit. It hasn't really worked that well. And under Amorim, Rashford started just three games in total, two in the Premier League and one in the Europa League. He's not started in the league since December 1st. He's not played a minute in the Premier League since December 7th. He's not played a minute in any competition since December 12th. And he's not even made the matchday squad in five of the 12 available under Amorim. And since being dropped from a starting lineup on December 1st, which I think was just after the Everton 4-0 win, Rashford's played just 62 minutes of a possible 630 in the league. Now,
like United have been, like, blowing the doors off people. Yeah, like, they could have used him in that time.
And I think part of this is due to the fact that he isn't a natural fit. His strengths are not amplified by the system. But there are obviously other issues that have been tabled. There are some off-pitch things that have been reportedly in the mix and obviously might have or will have affected Amorim's decisions to either include or subsequently not include him. One of which, him apparently being out on a Friday night the night before, or 2 days before the Everton game. Rashford denied that. Whether that's true or not is kind of irrelevant, but there have been other reports of him being like pretty lackluster at training again, potentially because he's been on nights out in the run-up to training, etc. And these could be true, these could be false. Rashford's reportedly denied them, but this isn't like new territory for Rashford. Remember last season when Erik ten Hag dropped him because he was spotted on a night out in Belfast on like a Wednesday and Thursday night and then called in sick for training on the Friday, got dropped for a game, and then, you know, ten Hag just pissed out and picked him the game after. But this isn't overly new ground, and whether it's true or not, the general vibe I get from Rashford is he's just very apathetic now. Like, he's just, he seems kind of done. He's given interviews where he said he's looking for a new challenge, which, you know, basically saying I want to leave. He's also given an interview where he said when I go move on there'll be no hard feelings. Basically all of the narratives that he's kind of put forward have, you know, seemed like his mind is made up that there's not much left for him. And that's really difficult for Amorim to even consider picking him. Because if the guy doesn't want to be there and the guy isn't overly performing when he is there and he doesn't fit into the system that you doesn't play the roles that you want him to play, or he isn't capable or isn't best suited to play the roles that you need him to play, it becomes a really, really significant uphill battle to include him. And then you've got a very, very expensive, because he's on over £300,000 a week, you've got a very, very expensive guy who's losing value by the day and is costing you £300,000 a week and is now 27. So you've got a once very valuable asset that you've invested a lot of money in that doesn't fit in the squad, doesn't seem like he wants to break his way into the squad, seems overly apathetic to the entire scenario, and when he does get on the pitch, hasn't really done much this season. Like, if numbers wise, like, they don't make for fantastic reading. He's got about 1,000 minutes in the league this year, if you include Ten Hag and Amorim. He's got 1.7 expected goals in total across those 1,000 minutes. That's 0.15 expected goals per 90, bottom third for the league. He's under 1.5 shots per 90, bottom 20%. He's bottom third for expected goal involvements per 90, key passes, expected assists. He's completing under a dribble per 90, bottom 15%. His dribble success rate is bottom 5%. He's making like half a tackle and completing one tackle and interception per 90, both bottom 10%. He's under two pressures per 90, which is only the 12th best in the United squad, below all of Xerxes, Garnacho, Hoyin, Diallo, Fernandez, people he's competing directly with for minutes. The only players he beats for pressures are the centre-backs, or a series of centre-backs, Onana, Mount and Eriksen. So he's not scoring or racking up a load of XG. He's not creating a load or racking up key passes or expected assists. He's not completing a lot of dribbles. He's not doing anything notable in the press or defensively. Like, when he's been on the pitch, and 1,000 minutes it's not a huge sample size, but it's enough to draw a good amount of conclusions from. He's not really done much. There's no real way that Amorim can look at his performances and his attitude so far this season and be like, I really need to get you back in the squad. Like, he's not really showed anything
It's quite shocking. Given that, like, he is a United Academy player. I mean, like, look, the way United have been over the last few years, I can kind of understand if he's like, look, there's a scenario in which both parties here can look at the situation and be like, you know what? We both got quite a lot out of each other. Like, Marcus Rashford got an absolutely shit ton of money at Man United that he would not have got anywhere else. Because while he was a very good player, like, he was more valuable to United because he was a youth academy player.
Yeah.
But, you know, United, there were three seasons in here, I'd say, where Rashford was, if not their best player, then very close to it. Yeah. You know, like, he was
one spectacular season.
Certainly scoring their goals. Yeah, he's had over 20 league goal involvements, I think, two or three times. But it's just... Oh, I don't know, man. Like, it's sad that it kind of has to end like this. And I also wonder if Rashford just overestimates his pulling power or underestimates how much he's going to have to drop his wages to make this happen. I mean, we'll go into that in a minute. But, like, whenever people talk about Rashford, So I was on a thing with like Zach and Henry recently, and they were talking about January transfers, and both of them were like, Arsenal should sign Marcus Rashford. And I was like, I'm sorry, guys, but like, you guys are fucking idiots. Like, like they absolutely
say what you really think, Patrick.
Well, I was just like, really?
Yeah.
Like, no, everyone always everyone's always like, he's a fantastic player. It's like, I've been a big fan of Rashford his whole career, but his 22-23 season was the really good one recently, right? That was his last recent good season. That's where he got 22 goal involvements in the league. And he had 0.6 expected goals and assists per 90 that season. That's very good. That's the only season in the last five that has been good. Mm-hmm. All the four around that, he's been 0.3 to 0.4 expected goals and assists per 90. All four seasons around that, including this one, which is like not only like not great, it's actually like bad. And in the season where he did that, where he had all those goals, he did it playing much more of a striker role. Like, it was fewer dribbles, lower dribble success, fewer defensive actions. So like, yeah, he might have notionally been stationed on the left, but he was basically playing as a centre forward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you were going to bring him in and say, well, he's a centre forward who plays on the left, that's all well and good. But if you're going to bring him in as a left winger, you've got to understand that potentially to get the goal output from him, you're going to have to accept that you get almost nothing else out of him. And that's been the kind of the problem for pretty much his whole career. He's like, I'm not a striker, but also I don't do any of the stuff wingers do. The last time he was a really useful dribbler that I could find was 2020, 2021, when he was 22, 23, which was, you know, two plus dribbles a game, over 50% success. That was the last time he was a plus dribbler. And I think that he's 27 now, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things about Rashford was he was always pretty explosive. He was he had a great shot from range.
Yeah.
But also he could accelerate quickly. He was just like more the combination of his upper body strength and his extreme speed were like really, really valuable. But now he's at an age where, look, he's not going to start being immediately slow, though he has got a lot of injuries in his past. But he's kind of post-peak now. Like a player at 27, if you give a four-year contract to that player, you're expecting that the last couple of years, even if they're still good, they're probably not as good as they are in the first two years.
I wouldn't say he's not post-peak, but he's at the back end of his peak years.
Normally for attackers, like the end of peak is like 28, and he's right there. And like, look, obviously it depends on the role, it depends how they're used and stuff, but like given that he has never played centre forward and sort of cultivated the abilities of a centre forward, which are like, look, maybe they move him as a centre forward and the drop off in pace doesn't really matter because he's still quicker than the average and he's still pretty strong and maybe he can still get that separation in the box and he's really useful. But equally, maybe you play him as a centre forward and he can't get that space in the box and he's done. And if you play him as a winger, he's no longer fast enough because he probably isn't fast enough if you play him as a winger. So those are kind of my issues. He's also got a lot of miles on him. So he's 27, but I looked at a couple of other 27-year-olds playing in the league right now. So I looked at Dominic Solanke. These were just like two guys who came up playing for top sides. There's Dominic Solanke and Gabriel, the Arsenal defender. So Dominic Solanke and Gabriel and Rashford are all 27. Solanke has 299 career appearances. Gabriel has 303 career appearances. Rashford has 486. So he's that's the equivalent of four extra seasons over those guys that he's played, right? Like 180 odd games more than those guys. It's like four seasons of football. And I'd say he's played in a more physically demanding position than center forward or center back. Like he's been playing wide, and pace is a bigger part of his game than both those two guys. All of those things, I think he's probably quite an old 27-year-old. He's also the same age as Gabriel Jesus. And, you know, before Christmas, people were like, Gabriel Jesus is cooked, man. He's got nothing left. Now, I don't think he has got nothing left, but I
do
think...
That is weird. That seems like it just shouldn't be true that Gabriel Jesus is the same age as Marcus Rashford.
I know, right? But, like, but Gabriel Jesus, he is at the point, clearly, where you think he's losing physicality. And he needs to compensate by doing other shit. Unfortunately, he's never been like super fast. He's never been a crazy dribbler. Like he's still pretty strong for his size. Like he's an intelligent player. So you'd hope he can last. And maybe he moves into when he leaves Arsenal, maybe he goes into a front two or something. But all this stuff with Rashford concerns me. like, it makes me wonder how much there is for him to give. I'm not saying he's useless. I'm not saying he's done.
Yeah.
But all I'm saying is that any team who gets him now is gonna is gambling big time.
This is a huge problem because it puts both Rashford and United in very, very difficult positions, because Rashford sees himself as like a high value player. You know, he's on £300,000 a week. He's been at one of the biggest clubs in the world, Premier League stalwart for years. He will see himself as having genuine decent value for a big team.
Yeah.
But like you say, he's not young. He's at the back end of his peak. I wouldn't say he's post-peak. I would say he's at the back end of his peak years. I think he's probably got another 18 months, if he doesn't get injured, 18 months in his peak era, especially if he starts to play regularly again. But he will cost a lot of money, even if you don't have to like pay a huge fee for him. If you have to like take him on a permanent with whatever fee you agree with United and pay like significant wages, it is a significant investment for a guy who hasn't been like good in 18 months. And even when he was like quote-unquote good, that was for quite a short period of time compared to his entire career. And outside of that, wages, the fact he has barely played, he's a really, for United to try and sell him, I don't think he's an overly attractive prospect. And I do not think there is a significant pool of genuinely feasible destinations that he can go to.
I'm trying to come up with a short list of places that isn't just like Saudi.
But he's not going to go to, like, I mean, it depends how bad the situation gets, and it depends how few offers come in for him. But
it also depends how much United are willing to subsidise. If he says, I'll take a pay cut and United subsidise it, then maybe you can get him for like 100k or something. That's still a fucking lot of money, but I can understand if you're, say,
most clubs, that'll be like top five, top six or top, in the club.
That's in the Prem. Like, I mean, looking at like say Inter Milan, for example, we're like, you know what? A guy who floats between like the wing and centre forward, and we're in a tight title race with Atalanta. Like that actually is a good player for us. Like, maybe we'll do it. For Inter Milan, that would still be top echelon of their earners. That's a lot of fucking money.
Same amount of money that Benjamin Pavard's on and Correa De Vrij. He's like top seven in Inter Milan squad if for £100,000 a week.
Yeah, and that's assuming you can get it down to 100k.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I look at the options here, and I'm like, well, let's not bother talking about Saudi because it's not very interesting. But look, it does still make sense. It always looks bad when you pay like 2/3 of a player's wages and they're going off to play for a rival. But from a club's point of view, especially United's point of view, where money is clearly an issue, it's still better to do that than pay 300k
for him to do nothing.
Yeah, because I think even if you can rehabilitate Rashford at this point, you kind of should be thinking about moving him on. Like, the best case scenario for United, even better than Rashford coming back into form for United, I honestly think the best case scenario for United is loan, plays well, gets a decent move for some money. Like, that is best, right?
So the only way out for Rashford, I don't think a big club or a club that he'd be happy going to, or a club that he'd be able to negotiate a palatable contract for himself, I don't think a club's going to come in, especially not in January, with a upfront full transfer straight in. Not necessarily upfront free, but like a full-on legitimate in-and-out standard transfer. I think the only option here is a loan with, for United's perspective, loan with obligation. From a buyer's perspective, loan with option, where United in both scenarios eat a fat chunk of his weekly wages. And immediately that rules out Arsenal, because Arsenal cannot loan any more English players this season. And to make that happen, even though I don't think it's worthwhile to even look at it, to make that happen, they would have to go through a huge rigmarole. They'd have to basically cancel Sterling's loan and all. Like, it's way too much moving parts, way too complicated. It's already complicated the best of times. I don't think Arsenal should touch Rashford with a barge pole.
No.
PSG is one that's... I think PSG will have more money than basically almost any other club in Europe.
And they've been struggling to score goals.
They have, but this just feels wrong.
They're also... they're trying to cut attackers right now. Like, they're trying to move on Mwani.
Mwani, yeah.
They're reportedly open to moving on Asensio and Lee. Like, I think they're open to moving on a load of guys. So maybe, you know, like, maybe you'd say, okay, Rashford comes in. But Rashford comes in the one position where there's a guy they adore, right? Because, yeah. like, they've got Bradley Barcola, who plays yeah. off the left wing, who's been fucking amazing. Like, so if he were, if Rashford were, like, a right winger, then I guess we'd be talking about Arsenal more seriously. But if Rashford yeah. were a right winger, we'd be talking about PSG more seriously. In this situation, I'm just like, oh, so is the plan, like, let's get Rashford and play him up front? Like, don't get me wrong, it's Ligue 1, that'll probably do sure. it. But, like, PSG don't give a fuck about Ligue 1. They're going to win yeah. Ligue 1. Like, their issue is the Champions League, and I don't think Rashford's a difference maker for them.
And also, like, this era of PSG is investing in youth. The previous era, the failed era of PSG was, like, the Mbappe, Neymar, Messi, whole Galacticos era. Signing Rashford feels more like that. Signing a guy who was good or might be very good but is a big name for a load of money and a load of wages, as opposed to what they're trying to yeah. do now and invest in youth and trying to build a genuine squad with a structure that isn't just full of like either post-peak or like really post-peak star players. So I don't
You know what else I'd say? Sorry, just before we get off this. If I had to think of two managers who would not be open to a guy who's leaving his previous club, supposedly because like he's a bit of a bad egg who doesn't train yeah. well, Arteta and Luis Enrique are the guys who would be least tolerant of that. Yeah. Luis Enrique is like he fucking hates that. And he's, like you say, he's basically been working his ass off trying to get PSG out of this like, we buy Galacticos and like, play like fucking idiots like yeah. situation and trying to get them to work as a team. Like it's the opposite of sensible. So yeah. what about Milan? I mean, Milan also doesn't make a huge amount of sense because, like, again, you're paying a load of money to get a guy in to play in the position where your fucking best player yeah. plays.
I think this is the most interesting of them all because, again, like, it's not an easy feat to find a destination for Rashford at this point of his career based on where he is and how he's been playing. But I think this has more legs than the other two significantly. So, oh, they play a 4-3-3. There is a role for him on that left wing that he could, when he gets on the pitch, he can kind of thrive in his probably preferred style and like positional play style. Rafael Leao is there and is there like go-to. But outside of him, there really isn't a huge amount at left wing. Pulisic has played there a bit, but he's predominantly been on the right. Outside of that, you've got like Noah Okafor. And then like the right back, Alex Jimenez has been playing at left wing when needed at points. So I think, okay, Rashford is expensive and I think this deal would hinge on the amount that United are going to eat in wages. That is really kind of the deal breaker. There's a pain threshold there as to it being potentially good or being a loss leader. But they don't have a huge amount of left wing options. Adding him, I don't think, will damage him and it's a natural role for him to play. Would also, if you get an option, say he plays well, you can sign him for a good fee and gives you a little bit of protection if Leao's head gets turned in the summer and moves. It doesn't leave you in a huge lurch. There's also a nice little English group at Milan already. You know, Ruben Loftus-Cheek is there, Tammy Abraham, Tomori's there. Pulisic is American, so he can cobble together a sentence in English. Okay.
Yeah, he could probably learn English.
Yeah. Like there's a little group there that Rashford could comfortably move to Milan and not feel completely ostracized and completely like out on his own.
Yeah.
In my opinion, Milan's a significantly nicer destination than Manchester. Serie A's fun again. You know, it's also featuring more British players than I can ever remember in my lifetime. There's also like success stories of players like McTominay, who you obviously played with at United for years, being kind of marginalised and underused or undervalued, at least from his perspective at United, going to Serie A and, you know, playing really, really well and getting loads of pitch time and receiving a lot of plaudits for his performances. That could only be a positive in at least going part way and convincing Rashford it's a potential move. And he's 27. Like, he's still, in my opinion, got at least two good seasons left, at least, like two good seasons if he can get playing. And then after that, who knows how quickly he'll decline. But if it's a loan with an option of a cup price for Rashford, where United eat a fat load of his wages just to get him off the books, for me, of the ones we're talking about, this is by far and away the most feasible. It's not ideal, but it's by far and away the most feasible for me.
Okay. How long does Rashford have left on his contract? Do you know?
1 second.
Let me try and find out. Because the thing is...
June 2028.
Oh, Jesus. See, that's the thing, man. Like, 3 years on a contract at 300K is a fucking lot of money to say goodbye to. Like, I mean, look, maybe he works out a payoff and he's just like, you know what? I've actually got a load of money and United are going to pay me out. If I'm going to make United pay me out like 30 mil or something. Yeah. And then I will also obviously have a contract at the new club. Like, maybe that works. But I just kind of think, like, it is so much money to say goodbye to. Because if you were Rashford and you just really wanted to, like, have the best possible career, the sensible thing would be to say to Dortmund, Milan, like, every possible interested team, guys, I'm going to pay for you for, like, 30K. You know, like, I will do what's called in the film industry, like, I will work for scale. So, like, essentially, I will work for industry minimum. Like, that would be, I think, like, the smart move. And then he could probably go to, like, fucking Atalanta. Like, I wouldn't go Dortmund, but, like, something like that. You know, like, a good team with a good coach where they're going to use you in a role that fits you and you get in the shop window and maybe you do get a good move in the summer. But I just don't think he will. Like, I think if he goes to Milan...
I guess Milan's too big.
Look, if Milan... come in with a good offer, like, he should absolutely go there, and I think it'll be a significant pay cut, but, like, that probably is the best of all worlds, unless he goes there and he doesn't play all fucking season because Leao plays every minute that he's available. And when they use Rashford, they're using him, you know, I don't know, in the cup, or they're using him on the right wing or some, you know, like, in some weird position. Like, then I just think that he emerges. I guess then he just goes back to United and sits on his contract some more, but it seems to me to be a risk. I guess if you ask me what the most likely outcome is, I guess that is the most likely outcome. But
There's no easy destination.
Yeah, there's just no good option, is there? I mean, is that what you think will happen? It looks like his agent's in Italy, I think, to talk to him.
I mean, I'm not sure it'll happen, to be honest. I think it's a really, really complicated deal. And it's basically, it all hinges on how much if it is Milan, so just for argument's sake, Milan are willing to pay in wages and what United are willing to pay. I think the stature of AC Milan is sufficient enough to massage Rashford's ego that he's not taking like a huge step down. I think going to like a Dortmund or like, let's say Atlanta, I don't think he'll drop down that much. Maybe Dortmund. That's probably about as far as he would be willing to fall for his ego. And that just makes it just a vanishingly small amount of potential suitors. I wouldn't be shocked if it happened, and I think it would be a good move for his career and for United. But like all parties involved, it has the potential to be good for everybody.
Yeah.
Him staying has the potential to be good for basically nobody. And it all comes down to money.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to come on to your player in a minute. I'm going to rip through mine really quickly. Because my one, it's not somebody who's going to move in January. But this is somebody who I think should be thinking about moving. And I've mentioned this before, but like Eduardo Camavinga, we're also going to talk about some players on the other side who I think are maybe interesting candidates here. But Eduardo Camavinga, Real Madrid are in an interesting point with their midfield because they've added a ton of midfielders and they supposedly want another midfielder now. And they're going to have a managerial change this summer. So look, maybe Xabi Alonso comes in this summer and he's like, Camavinga is my guy. And honestly, that would make a lot of sense because Camavinga, I think, could do like the kind of Palacios role. Like, he's capable of doing a bit of everything in midfield. Maybe that just happens. But when you look at the shape of things right now at Real Madrid, he's been a bit injured this year, so he's only played about 700 minutes across the league and Champions League. Only about half of those have been in midfield. Now, obviously, that started last season. He did still mostly play in midfield last season, only a few hundred minutes out of position, but he was playing at left back. He does still get shunted around midfield. Like, when Tchouaméni is there, Tchouaméni's kind of the six, and so Camavinga kind of plays like a shuttling role. So it's quite rare that you see Camavinga play in what I consider to be his best position, which is like the guy in front of the back line hoovering stuff up and passing the ball out. Now, don't get me wrong. Who knows? In the long run, because he's still super, super young, you know, he only turned 22 last month. He could just be a great eight. Like, he does have all the ability to be a great eight. He's an incredible dribbler. Like, 1.7 dribbles a game is really good for a midfielder. Across his career, his dribble success rate is like 60%, which is bananas, especially for a guy who was playing at like 16, 17 years old. Loads of passes into the final third, loads of progressive passes a game. He's probably still 2 years pre-peak. His defensive action numbers have always been crazy, crazy. So there's enough here. There's a breadth of ability here. And he could be a six, he could be an eight. But he's rarely had a run at Real Madrid playing the same position all the time. And right now, you know, like Danny Ceballos has been playing quite a bit. Tchouaméni is playing centre back because of injuries. Yeah. And Camavinga still doesn't start every game that he's fit.
No.
And I do think when you look at Real Madrid's midfielders, would they choose Camavinga over Tchouaméni? Yeah, probably. Would they choose him over Bellingham? Don't think so. You know, they spent so much money on Bellingham. Would they choose him over Valverde? I don't know. Valverde's homegrown. They love him. So, look, maybe Xabi Alonso comes in and he basically says to Florentino Perez, like, I have power to do whatever I want. Whatever I want. Mm-hmm. If I bench Mbappe and Bellingham, you fucking shut up and you just accept that that's how it works. But it's rare that a manager does have that power at Real Madrid. And it's certainly rare that it lasts because your results need to be good to have that sort of power. And I just kind of think that because of his versatility and because of these other favourites in the squad who are like virtually untouchable, it's going to be quite hard for him to just have that role that he wants forever at Real Madrid. And he's still young enough that he could go basically anywhere and turn into whatever he wants. Like, I love the player. I still do expect him to be a star at Real Madrid. But if this summer Man City were like, Rodri's coming off a big injury and he's nearly 30. Or Liverpool were like, hey, you know what? We've won the league, but you know what we could do? We could just push like McAllister and Gravenberch further forward, and we could just try and buy like Camavinga and play him as a six. I think Camavinga would be incredible and would make an awful lot of sense. And when you think about the prices in the Premier League, probably you could get Camavinga for what would amount to a good price.
Yeah. Considering like, what they bid for like Caicedo and Lavia.
I think Camavinga would cost, like, people were always like, Real Madrid won't sell for less than like 150 mil. That's bullshit. Real Madrid can't just sit on players who are earning a ton of money and who have a ton of value and just not use them. Like, Real Madrid are going to have to use these guys or sell them. Like, you just can't do it. Like, I'm sorry, but like, I was talking to Ted about this, and Ted was basically saying, you know, we're at kind of the first point where TV rights deals are going down. Like, the value of TV rights deals are going down. And that means that where in the past a club could lose money but still appreciate in value because of TV rights deals and because of, like, potential earnings, like, that may stop happening. And then owners are going to be like, well, why would I put money into this club when the money is when the club is depreciating? And at that point, transfer fees start to come down. And actually, transfer fees have come down. We've never seen fees touch the Mbappe, Neymar money that we saw a few years ago. Like, we're nowhere near that. And it seems like when you look at the fees being bandied around now around top players, they're less than they were. You know, like, obviously it depends. If you go and try and get Leao, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. But Chelsea paid like 70 mil for Havertz. Arsenal paid 70 mil for Nicolas Pepe. Those players would not cost that amount of money now.
No.
And Ted's point was basically that if you get interest from the Premier League now for a player that you don't really need, and potentially you think that transfer fees are going to go down over the next couple of years, it makes sense to sell aggressively with those guys who you're not using. So from Real Madrid's point of view, if they could get, like, who needs a midfielder? Spurs, Man United, City, Liverpool, Arsenal, like, literally all the top teams need a central midfielder this summer, like, in the Premier League. If Real Madrid could get like two or three of those seriously interested in Camavinga, which I do not think would be hard, they could genuinely pick up a huge fee for him just before all this shit kind of like the bottom falls out of it.
For a guy they're playing at left back as well.
Yeah.
Like, his last two appearances for Madrid have been at left back, one off the bench.
The problem is, I think a lot of people are kind of childish about this, and they think that all that matters to players is that they play at the best clubs and that they get the most trophies. And that's not true. We see time and time again that players want to play. They also want to earn a lot. They want to play in their preferred position. Like, there are lots of different things that go into their decisions. And Camavinga would not be leaving Real Madrid to go and play for like some bumfuck team. He'd be going to play for one of the best teams in the world. Yeah. And we've seen Kovacic do it. We've seen Urgor do it. Like, players want to go and play. They don't just want to sit on the Real Madrid bench or come off the Real Madrid bench, even if it means picking up tons and tons of trophies. So Camavinga, I think, is an interesting one. I think Real Madrid are in a situation right now where I would be, every time there's talk about Barcelona needing money, I would go to Barcelona and be like, I want to take five of your academy kids. You know, I'll give you like 20, I'll give you like, not 20 mil, but I'll give you like, I'll give you like, you know, 10 mil.
Like, the fucking child snatcher turns up at the Mazia.
I'll give you somewhere between 2 and 5 mil, 2 and 10 mil for like a bunch of your like best academy kids. And like, that's just money you can bank right now. And similarly, I would probably go to Real Madrid every summer and be like, who are you not using? Like, tell me how much you would want for this guy. And they're going to tell you a crazy price for like, they're going to tell you a crazy price for Rodrigo. They're going to tell you a crazy price for Camavinga. But maybe not as crazy as Brighton saying 120 for Caicedo. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think about that. Anyway, let's go on to your player. We went long on Rashford, man.
We went really long. We went way long on Rashford. Rashford was meant to be like the B-side into this.
But, okay, but I do think that in the player that you're about to talk about,
yeah,
we have covered a load of stuff with Rashford.
Yeah.
Which overlaps here. I think that a lot of the stuff is a real problem in the Premier League of just like you've signed a player for you've got a player who's very valuable to you and who you've given huge wages to and yeah. Now you can't fucking move him.
So this is a player I don't think is necessarily going to move in January, but again, from probably largely similar reasons to Rashford, although his scenario isn't quite as bad as Rashford's. But it's a player that I feel just there's nothing left for him at the club he's at. And the player I've gone for is Jack Grealish.
Yeah.
Because I really like, at least I did like Jack Grealish. I really loved the transfer. I loved him at Villa. Didn't love the price, but like, fair enough. He was a bit old at that stage. But for me, he's been more of a miss than a hit at City for the £100 million I paid for him in 2021. Like, he openly said that he was crap in his first season. He got six goal involvements in like 2,000 minutes, about half of his expected goal involvements. He played a much, much more significant role in the second season, which was the treble season. Hit double figures. Goal involvements, the only time he's done that at City, only time he hit more than 2,000 minutes in the league as well. And he started in all of the big games. He started 12 games in the Champions League and all of the 7 knockout games. He was the only player in the squad to do that. So City's most successful season in their history, he was a huge integral part of it, specifically at the business end of it. So second season, end of that season, you think, okay, this is where he starts to come into his own. And it looked like he was going to become like the 2,500-3,000 minutes a season player that like KDB and Rodri and eventually Haaland would go on to be. But then last season, he barely scraped over 1,000 league minutes despite being available for selection for 30 of the 38 league games. He featured in just 40% of the possible minutes for City in the league that season despite being in the squad for 82% of them. So he was literally on the bench just not being chosen to come on the pitch. Mm-hmm. And in that season, he managed 4 goal involvements from an expected goal involvements of 4.6. Like, he didn't really do a huge amount last season. And even worse than that, and this isn't so much of a stick to beat him with, but his 3 goals that season came in consecutive games in December. So basically, that little flurry purple patch in December 2023 was bookended with large, large portions of ineffectiveness where he basically did nothing. And the goal he scored in December 2023 was the last time he scored a league goal. It might actually be the last time he scored for City. I'm not sure if it's in the league. He's definitely not scored in the league. December 2023, we're in January 25 now. And there was times that last season where he was like literally being overlooked and not picked instead of Matheus Nunes playing out of position on the left. And you're thinking, this guy is a, you know, at that stage he would have been 28, £100 million signing who was like really, really good player. And he's being overlooked from Matheus Nunes out of position. Obviously last season wasn't good for him. He ended up missing out on the Euros as well. Hard decision to argue, like based on the players that Southgate took, you would look at all of the players playing in similar positions and doing the similar roles that Grealish would do, and you'd be like, I cannot make a single case for you to go ahead of one of these guys who's been selected. And it's not gotten better this season. He's featured in 14 of City's 20 league games this season so far at the time of recording, but he's totaled under 600 minutes. He's averaging about 40 minutes per appearance, and he's barely done anything. He's got under 0.8 expected goals total across those 600 minutes. In like 14 games, 0.1 expected goals per 90.
And this was in a team as well where you were like, surely they'll just try anything. Surely they will try anything now. Like, they need, like, shit is so bad that they have to try whatever. And during that run, like, Grealish got some minutes, but it wasn't like, well, Pep turns to Jack Grealish to salvage the situation. He was like, nah, fuck this guy. Like, I don't want to use him.
And it was the same. It's the same this season as it was last season. And you know, he's unsurprisingly, his career output or his expected goal involvement per 90 is a career low this season. And I just don't see what's left from at City. Like, especially considering Pep signed on for more seasons too. Like, Pep has turned him into this little, like, artificial intelligence made cuckold of a winger. Like, devoid of any of the originality he once had. Like, at Villa, he was a super exciting direct player, and I really see, like, so little left in him of that. And that's obviously not to say he's not doing other things. Like, I think you've spoken about when Grealish goes multiple years not getting a load of goal involvement, you look at what else he's doing. But I think it's such a shame for that, the magic from him to have been stripped. Like, in the 2021 season, his last season at Villa, he was competing over three dribbles, or nearly three dribbles per 90. That fell to under two in his first two seasons at City. It fell again to 1.6 per 90 last season. It's gone up a little bit this season, but it's still under 1.9.
He's playing sub-minutes, you'd expect that.
And it's a negligible uptick as well.
I don't think it's that he can't do it, necessarily, though maybe he can't do it. It's clearly that Pep is just like, I don't like this, don't do it.
And this thing, like, I just think this pigeonhole version of Grealish wastes, like, all or most of the attributes that were the reason behind him being valued and purchased for £100 million. And it's got to the stage now that Pep's even calling him out in public. Like, he said earlier this week that Savinho's in better shape than him and that he wants Grealish to, like, quote-unquote, fight for his place. And if I was Grealish, I'd be like, are you fucking kidding, bro? Grealish came for a load of money and basically just let Pep rewire him to his liking. And he's now being criticised for the player he is based on Pep's making. And, like, even after playing a huge role in City's most successful season ever. And, like, if you look back at this era of dominance with City and say you compare it to, like, the class of 92 United dominance in the 90s with the treble, obviously both the two treble winning teams. When you think of, like, City, I think of, like, Kevin De Bruyne, I think of Rodri, I think of later years Haaland, I think of Ederson, I think of Walker. I don't really think of Jack Grealish in the same way I would think of United's 99 team. Like, you would think of Scholes, you would think of Beckham, you would think of Keane, you would think of maybe York and Cole, Schmeichel, you would think of, like, these huge players, Yap Stam. You wouldn't think of, like, Jesper Blomqvist or David May or Nicky Butt, who played roles in those teams and those seasons, but that to me is, like, more of the equivalent of what Jack Grealish will be looked at in 20 years in this City era than the players that he potentially could have been had he not just been, like, castrated by Pep to fit this, like, very specific role that Pep wanted him to play.
I think they'll seem like Fernando Torres at Chelsea, where they're like, wow, this was, like, a huge...
Do you think it'd be that bad?
Well, I mean more in the sense that, like, Torres cost them an arm and a leg. It was, like, just this enormous transfer fee. And then he, like, won the Champions League with them and it was, like, enormous. But, like, he was never really good there. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that Grealish has been that bad, but I'm just saying that, like, it's not quite the same as, like, Blomqvist and Nicky Butt, because everyone's like, well, those guys were just, like, perfectly serviceable squad players.
Sure.
Whereas with Grealish, they'll be like, this guy was very important to them winning. Like, he had one really good season where they won everything.
Yeah.
And then he disappeared. Like,
but it was also in the
era,
kind of like the back end of the era of the kind of sports washing, money's no object kind of thing. So I don't think the money is that important to say. Well, actually, it depends what happens with the 116 charges. But yeah. But, like, I just don't think either way you cut it, whether it's Blomqvist or whether it's Torres, I think it's like, you're not looking back at this era of City dominance and thinking Jack Grealish was a huge portion of that, even though he did play a significant part in one season. And I just think, like, there's nothing left for him there. Like, he's won everything he can. His trophy cabinet is better than most in the game, the vast majority of the players in the game.
So getting old.
And,
like,
this
people keep saying, like, oh, I'd take great... Like, I always see these fucking idiots, like, saying, you know, like, these fucking idiot English pundits being like, Tottenham Hotspur, they'd be crazy not to sign Jack Grealish. You're like, Jack Grealish is fucking nearly 30 years old.
His next birthday is his 30th birthday. Everybody seems to have... The narrative around Grealish is that they've perpetually been waiting for him to, like, quote-unquote, kick on. Since he was, like, 25, since he moved, being like, oh, he's got to kick on now. Oh, he's had a good season last season, he's going to kick on now. He's turning 30 on his next birthday.
Yeah, he is post-peak.
This is not a young player. This is not a player that's going to, like, hugely develop. It's a player that could definitely find form again and has a use. But this is not a player. I don't know. I've never understood the narratives around him, why everybody just seems to have ignored the fact that he's slyly gotten old. Uh-huh. And I just don't, like, Cole Palmer's obviously, like, the success story of, like, once you're unshackled from Pep's system and have a bit of freedom, a type of player that could thrive in that. I could see Jack Grealish. He's not so old that he can't go if he's given freedom in a club that's not as well, just not run by Pep, and he's like given creative freedom to do what he was good at Villa. I can see that being potentially beneficial, and he's not too old at this point. If he waits another season or two, he's getting to this date where he is too old, and like he's not getting on the pitch, he's getting sub minutes, he's getting overlooked for national selection of big tournaments. If you look at City squad, of all the players who can play in like the similar Grealish roles, the only player who has less minutes on him in the league this season is Nunes, who is like also shoehorned into that position, out of position. So it's like basically of all of the recognised natural players playing in those Grealish type roles, he is bottom of the pile. Doku, Bernardo, Savinho, Foden all have played more. Even if you look at the central players, Kovacic, Bruyne, Gundogan, all have played more. Like, there is no space for Grealish to get substantial minutes. The only players who have played less than him this season are Nunes, Ake, Stones, Simpson, Pussy, McAtee and Rodri. Rodri's obviously injured. So I still think there's value in him. Not a huge amount of value, but I still think there's a player there that can be that can do things at a Premier League level. Surely a £100 million player that has just tipped into his post-peak era at this stage has a little bit more left in him. I reckon if you can nick him for a good price, like people should consider him.
Who should consider him? Give me a guy. Because good price to me is like 30 mil.
I was going to say somewhere under 50. And if
a guy who's about to be 30 and who hasn't played well in like 18 months. Ooh.
Under 50.
If City can get 50, then like fair
under
play
50.
To them.
So I was thinking like somewhere in the 40s.
But in a way, it sucks for them because like the obvious team who always spend and who you could imagine doing it are Villa, who are not going to go back for him. Like, and you know, maybe like a Newcastle, but I don't think Newcastle could do it either. So I just don't know. I don't know what there is. Like Spurs could use him, but they're not going to pay 50 mil for him. They might loan him.
Yeah, this is why I don't think he's going to move. Certainly not in January. And again, like Rashford is a really, really difficult thing because he's a player that has a overly inflated self-valuation based on his career performances as a whole.
Yeah.
Was bought for a load of money and is on significant wages more so than he's worth, certainly based on the output he's had. It's a tough one, but I just don't see there's anything left from it, City.
Agreed. Let's move on to the burn book. All right, burn book time. Do you want to go in? Do you want to go out?
Right.
What's appealing?
Oh no, my notes are frozen. Where are they? Okay, I'm going to go in. Something I hated seeing. What I'm putting in the burn book this week are social groups at gender separation.
Ooh, yes.
This is born out of me seeing a picture online from like, you know the way you have old friends, like school friends, people you were friends with when you were like 15, and you just like follow each other on social media. You haven't spoken in decades, but you know like a weird amount about their like life milestones, like when they got married and how many kids they have just through social media. Like they pop up and you're like, oh, they have another kid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A picture of somebody I knew decades ago popped up. It was like this woman out with her girlfriends for like a Christmas dinner, like a Christmas celebration, some evening when they were all back in Bangor. And all of the women were sitting at a table, just like looking at the camera, smiling. But then you looked further back at the table that was just right behind them, in line with him, but with a small separation. And I was like, oh, all those men are also looking at the camera. Quite far away from the lens. But I was like, and I zoomed in and I was like, oh no, that's her husband. And I recognize her. So I think I'm pretty sure that's her partner. And I was like, wait. This group of 10 couples, 20 people have gone out and consciously separated themselves into female and male. Because I assume they were just like, well, I'm a bloke and I'm not going to want to talk about...
What am I going to talk to a bird about?
Yeah, and similarly, they'll be like, well, I don't want to talk... You're going to talk about like football or something. Like, we would never have mutual... Be able to have like this mutually interesting conversation.
Mm.
And I just thought that is so depressing because like... I kind of equated it to what it would be like if we did that. Like, imagine we went out for dinner in a group. You, me, Jess, and Emma, and whoever else. Yeah. And I had zero interest in speaking to Emma at all, to the point where I would actually move away.
Understandable.
But, like, when we meet up, I'm like, I'm interested in your life as much as I'm interested in Emma's life. And, like, the fact that you would want to segregate that in such a clear and obvious and like ridiculous way. I was like, what world are these people living? It seems like they're perhaps the same people as like the ones who don't allow their partner to have close friends of the opposite gender, of the opposite sex. You know,
freaks.
The ones who are like, you can't have close female friends because, like, I don't know, what would you talk to them about?
Yeah, especially when you're just
other
like
than, no, other than cheating on me,
and you're like, that guy is not going to cheat on anyone. Like he's like the fact he's got one woman to be interested in him is remarkable. I feel like always that it's like how worried people are about cheating is in like inverse proportion to the odds their partner is capable of cheating on them.
Mm, I think it's just the level of like emotional like stunted emotional development was staggering, because it wasn't just like one person. This is a collective. This was like 10 people and 10 people. I struggled to even comprehend putting myself in a scenario where I thought that like I'd be comfortable with that scenario in my with my friendship group. Sure. Like I just couldn't believe I can barely come to terms with like your closest friends, partners, you just having like zero interest or like not even zero interest in them, as I like zero ability to have a enjoyable conversation with them over dinner.
I'm
so
not even
so
gonna
that
pretend
you're segregating.
I can't even pretend to be interested in them for like an hour and a half.
And I'm just like, oh, it sat really weird. I mean, I still don't know what to make of it fully, other it's than that weird. I hate it. But it's just,
but
yeah.
I feel this way. I mean, that is a really extreme example.
Yeah, yeah.
But
that was what shocked me because it was so visceral as well.
But you and I have also talked about people in the past who go out like with the boys, and it's literally like 20 guys.
Yeah, yeah. And they're like in their 30s.
And you're kind of like, that's fucking weird. Like, you just go out, like, with your group of friends, but your group of friends is just a group of men that you knew when you were, like, 18. Like, have you not developed at all? Do you have nothing else? I don't know. That to me, is, like, a super red flag. It's like, you don't have anything to talk to a woman about.
Both
you're
of those
weird.
Scenarios are one and the same.
Sure. All right.
Yeah,
I think this is impossible to disagree with. What I'm putting in the burn book this week... it's kind of a cheat in the way, because what I'm putting in the burn book is non-fiction, and in reality I have nothing against non-fiction. Non-fiction's fine. Like, you're allowed to read non-fiction books. Loads of them are really good and interesting. However, basically I tweeted about this the other day because I saw an article about 75 hard, you know, this like TikTok fitness challenge.
I hate that. I know people have done it. It's just...
It's like you do two workouts a day. One of them has to be outside. I was like, already crazy. Two workouts a day is fucking mental. What are these people doing for a living? Like, two workouts a day, you're going to drink like 3 liters of water, which you should fucking do anyway. And then it's like, and you should read 10 pages of a non-fiction book. And I was like, that's such a weird thing to specify. Yeah. Because it implies that like reading non-fiction is like really good for you. And it's better for you than reading fiction. They could just say 10 pages of reading.
Yeah.
But they don't. They say 10 pages of nonfiction. And I was like, that tells you exactly the sort of person who does this fucking challenge. It's the kind of person who's like, I've read 20 books already in 2025. And you look at the list and it's literally like Atomic Habits, like fucking Thinking Fast and Slow. Like, you know, I'm not saying that all of these books are like total bullshit, but it's basically like popular self-help.
Yeah.
It is self-help. And... in the 90s, we called it self-help and we kind of laughed at it. And the idea of reading self-help was slightly embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a bit much, you know, like that was kind of silly. It's okay to read self-help. But now self-help is like held up as this amazing thing that we should all engage in. We should all read these self-help books. And they're not like particularly involved. It's all just stuff like, oh, I read Jordan fucking Peterson, or... oh, I read, you know, at best, it's like I read an interesting book that's not self-help, but is just like kind of, I don't know, some shit that like The Guardian would write a review of, like Sapiens or whatever the fuck. Mm. Like it's never really challenging. It's never really interesting. And also fundamentally, this idea that like I will become a better person by reading these kind of books. I'm sorry, but you won't. You might become a more efficient person in some way. But over the last 30 years, there's been an enormous growth in this industry.
Yeah.
Has it coincided with people becoming like better fucking people?
I'd argue the worst. The opposite,
We've ended up with like a society run by kind of like tech guys who are just like, the most important thing is that like, you know, you're very, very efficient at work. the important thing is that when you make a decision, you understand like which decision-making process you're using. No, it fucking isn't. You know what's actually good is like compassion and the imagination to understand other people, or a willingness to be curious about other people's lives, like all this kind of stuff. And that is all stuff that fiction teaches you. Fiction also teaches you to be a good writer. It is impossible to be a good artist if you only consume nonfiction. There are no good artists who do that. Every good artist in the world consumes fiction. Like that is just the truth. And I do meet people who are like, you know, I'm actually a pretty good writer, or, you know, I want to be a writer. And then it's like, what do you read? And they read nonfiction. I'm like, no, sorry, you're never going to be a good writer. I'm not joking at all. It's literally not possible. Especially not like popular nonfiction is not written in an interesting way. You need to read fiction and be a real person. And it's also a massive problem that it's become super gendered as well. Like, men do not write fiction. Men don't read fiction. Men are not that involved in the publishing industry anymore. It is overwhelmingly female dominated. And that's not because there's bias against men. It's because men are clearly contemptuous of it. Like, men don't read fiction. Like, most people, if you said to them, like, if you said to a load of the men, you know, what did you read this year? Or if you ask like your uncle or your dad or someone, you know, like an older man in your life, like what he reads, it's so rare that they're reading fiction. And I think that is a real, real problem. To me, all the things that are good in human nature are cultivated by reading fiction. Fiction is more challenging as prose. More challenging as prose. It's better for your verbal development. And also, I think it's not helped by the fact that most of these popular nonfiction books are kind of total bullshit snake oil that convince that I think as well a part of the kind of entrepreneurification of our society. Everybody thinks that they're on the fucking Apprentice. Everybody just kind of acts like they're on the Apprentice at all times. They're like, I'm an entrepreneur, like I'll fucking hustle step culture. Over anybody to get heard. I'm gonna hustle. Like, what's really important is to think about
work
yourself.
Now, relax,
you know,
later.
You don't owe anybody anything. I would never date somebody who doesn't
earn six figures.
Who isn't at my level or doesn't earn six figures, or, you know, who doesn't push me to improve myself in some way. Like, I'm sorry, but you're not a real person and you're not treating other people as if they're real people. Fiction encourages that ability. So if you read a bunch of nonfiction, that's better than not reading anything, but try and incorporate some fiction. If you don't read anything, please read some fiction. And if you don't, if you're like, oh, I don't, sometimes people, I say this and people will say like, well, I don't know, like I can't find books that I like that is a fucking skill issue. There are books of all kinds available at all times on all subjects. Like, put some fucking effort into finding them. Like, stop watching Friends reruns. Stop thinking about how you're going to be an influencer one day, because you're not, and read a fucking book. So that's my thing. What are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book is fiction, but a more mind-numbing version of fiction. Or not mind-numbing version of fiction, a less taxing version of fiction. So what I want to take out of the burn book,
oh my God,
are 90-minute easy watching films.
Oh, sure.
Over Christmas, Jess and I both got sick at different parts, like kind of either side of Christmas Day, really. And subsequently I spent a lot of time in bed and on the sofa in that kind of interim week between Christmas and New Year. And I didn't have the desire to do anything substantial. I also didn't want to concentrate too much or think too hard. So I ended up revisiting a lot of like the 90s noughties, fodder comedies, rom-coms, the ones that are like 90 minutes that require like zero effort. You know, shit like Happy Gilmore, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. I fucking watched Harold and Kumar Get the Munchies the other day. Like,
okay.
These things that like whatever, just random shit that you know is not, it's not good or substantial or meaningful in any way, but it's enjoyable and it's very, most notably, it's very, very easy. And it made me realise, though, that all of these films are, they're all totems of a bygone era, because like shifts in cinema and the way people consume film has killed these off, basically, because like streaming has killed the DVD, and which in turn has made filmmaking generally just more risky, like in terms of the capital investment of it. So like these 90s and noughties movies could be made because they could go out in cinemas and not make a ton in box office, but they'll know they'll get a huge kickback when they release in DVD, they'll get a second windfall, and they'll have a good chance of making it, whatever the project was, financially viable. Without the DVD sales now, basically all those investments are far riskier because they need to do a lot more in the box office. And it means that all these like middle grounds of kind of shitty little like funny movies or feel-good movies that are like 90 minutes, easy watches with like still genuinely good talent have just fallen away. And basically like films now are either superhero franchises or 2.5+ hour long epic films that are like super heavy and dense and like theatrical and require like a load of concentration. And there isn't a huge amount in between. Certainly not in the same way of these, like, you know, the canon of Adam Sandler movies that came out in the 90s. Like those just don't, well, I suppose Adam Sandler's actually a terrible example because he's kind of the one that still makes these shit movies.
Yeah.
But like all of the ones with like, you know, Katherine Heigl, Kate Hudson, Renée Zellweger, Reese Witherspoon, Matthew McConaughey, like the rom-coms with them, or comedies with like Vince Vaughn and Ben Stiller, fucking Sean William Scott, Stifler. I reckon there's people listening to this podcast who are too young to know who Stifler is, when Stifler was like a defining character of our teenage years from American Pie.
Yeah,
Stifler. And it just feels like the American Pie series just wouldn't have been made, won't have been made if it was pitched now as opposed to in the mid to late 90s. And these films, like, they're not fantastic. They're not deserving of any awards, but they're easy. And I think there is still like a value in them, in the enjoyment you can get for like this mindless, unassuming enjoyment you can get from them. And they just don't require any mental bandwidth to enjoy. And I think there's a huge hole in the industry for them now as well, because the versions that they've been replaced with are like the straight to streaming, whatever, with, I don't know, like Chad Michael Murray and Vanessa Hudgens. And the difference there is that,
well, no,
they're shit.
Well, or they're 30 minutes longer than they should be and they cost $300 million. So like shit like Red One coming out of Christmas, you're like,
I actually haven't watched that yet.
No, no one has. Like, but you look at that and you're like, they should have made this for 20 mil and it should be 90 minutes long. I haven't seen how long it is, but I bet it's long as fuck. And it's, you know, it's just like an overblown disaster. Like Netflix make a bunch of these every year. And so there are all these fucking films where, because they want to get The Rock involved, and The Rock is the most overpaid man on the surface of the earth.
It's over 2 hours, which is too long.
Yeah, of course it is. Like, so this is the situation we're in now. Like, instead of just making like decent, cheap, short films
with like B to C list celebrities, but the film itself is still good.
Yeah.
In its own right. And yeah, there's just a huge hole in the market for it that won't be filled.
Roger Corman, like legendary producer of B-movies, he said once, there's no film that couldn't be improved from being 20 minutes shorter and having a helicopter blow up in it. And I was like, fuck yeah. Like, like you're not wrong. Like whenever you say this, a load of film bros are kind of like, sorry your attention span's so poor, bro. It's just like, sorry that your editing ability is so poor that you don't understand that films can generally have 20 minutes chopped out of them,
yeah,
and it would improve them. Like, this idea that everything should just be as long as the creator wants it to be is simply not true. Editing is really important.
Also, it's not even about, like, your attention span not being, like, sufficient.
No, I know.
It's like, there's sometimes I want to eat fucking fried chicken or instant ramen. Like, it's not because I don't have a good palate, it's because I'm just in the fucking mood to eat instant ramen.
Yeah.
Because it's nice and it's enjoyable and it's easy. I haven't watched films like this in a while, and I've knocked off like, this is the thing, I've knocked off like 6 or 7 of them in 2 weeks, 2 or 3. I just put them on, like, they're like, I watch most of them, but like a lot of them, like, you'll fade in and out of. I would not watch what's been released recently that's like heavy, Oppenheimer.
Sure.
I would not watch 5 of them in 4 months, and I've watched 7 of these movies in like 2 weeks. And I think
I approve.
That is the simple joy of it. That it's a shame that I'm having to revisit ones from the 90s and there's not substantial ones being made anymore, or will be.
Agreed. All right. What I'm taking out of the burn book, cafetiere coffee. So,
okay.
I used to drink this years ago. And then, you know, we kind of went on to like pour over coffee.
You got a fancy one, didn't you?
Went on to pour over, then got an espresso machine, blah, blah, blah. And I was kind of like, I don't want to drink cafetiere anymore because it's kind of weak shit coffee. And look, those things are not entirely untrue. It is fucking weak. Like, it is weak. It's always weird to me that, like, when you watch, like, Emma tried to get me into, like, Gilmore Girls, and she's always, it's not cafetière coffee, but they have just, like, you know, the coffee percolator thing. And in that show, like, the main character is always just like, oh my God, like, I have to get my coffee. And we were just like, but that's really weak coffee. You can have one of, like, the coffee you're having is like, when you're drinking 6 cups of coffee, you're actually kind of drinking like 1.5. Like, just have a real coffee. And I was kind of like, it's not as good. And when I drink it, it isn't as good. It isn't as good as an espresso machine. It isn't as good as a pour over coffee, in my view. But I think there's value to be had in a nice kind of like easy coffee. It's not too strong. And more importantly, I like that it's social. Like, when you're using the espresso machine, unless you've got a fancy one, you're making like one at a time.
Yeah.
It's kind of a ball ache. Like, it's really a thing you're doing for yourself. Because even if you're making one for you and for your partner, you've kind of got to make one after the other. It's not that fun. When you make a cafetière, you can just like enjoy it with friends. You can sit down with your partner and like share a cafetière of coffee together. And I like the social element of it. So Emma and I have started making coffee in the cafetière again, and just like, we're making coffee for each other much more often than we used to, because it's far less laborious. You know, you can just like put the coffee in the thing, let it brew, and then it's ready to go, rather than like fiddling around with like
the French press plunger coffee.
Yes.
So, and for whatever reason, my head went to the moka pot.
No, the moka pot. Okay, the moka pot is the chicest way of making coffee. But
I like the moka pot.
It's fucking dreadful coffee.
In what sense?
It's burnt. Like, Italians love it, and Italians are always like, hold on. If you think it's burnt, let me make you a coffee with the moka pot. And they serve you a coffee from the moka pot, and you're like, yeah, you've burnt that.
I like it.
I still enjoy it. I still enjoy it because I quite like a hard roast. But the moka pot, I do think, is objectively not a very good way of making coffee. But it is a fun, chic way. It's also not a very...
I think it's good as long as you take it off the heat as soon as it comes out. Like, you can't leave it and they're still on the heat, but yeah.
I've got time for all the methods. It's not like I'll never drink a moka pot coffee, but whenever people are like, that's how I make my coffee, I'm kind of like, you're trying to be cool because you know it's an Italian thing to do, but objectively, it's not a great...
That was the way I made coffee until I got an espresso pod machine.
Yeah, because it's better.
It is better.
It's better.
It is better.
That's the thing, you know? So you have a moka pot in your house, maybe, because, you know, you were once a single man. And you're like, there was a period there, where I was cool and I made a coffee for myself.
I have a massive one that makes like 4 or 5 people drink coffee.
That's fucking crazy. But like, look, I've got time for it. It's just not my preferred method. Okay, that'll do us. We're going to move on to the paid side so you can catch us over there. I also wrote something that went up on the Patreon a few days ago, so you can check that out if you want. Thank you very much for your questions. We're going to be answering one of those over on the paid side, and we really appreciate your subscriptions as well. Like, we've recently hit an all-time high for paid subscribers, and that's really like heartening. We've been doing this, as Pete says, we're in our 4th calendar year now. So finally, I guess this is the year that we go like fucking super viral and we just have like 10,000 subscribers and we quit our jobs.
Only if we read 10 pages of nonfiction a day, though, because that would make us better people.
Exactly, obviously. We would probably have a more efficient podcast. Okay, thanks very much. We'll catch you on the other side. Bye.